Okay. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. You'll see Dane's name in the chat. It's really me. Dane and I share the account. So I'll throw my email in the chat in a minute. If you have any issues or questions after the webinar, feel free to reach out. I will get back to you and work through anything that you need. A couple of reminders before we get started today. A copy of today's PowerPoint is on our webpage, nysrti.org, under Professional Development and then under Current Webinars. All professional development opportunities can be found on our webpage, so check that frequently as we always have new things coming up. During today's webinar, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's webinar, we'll share a link to a brief evaluation. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We appreciate your feedback and for completing today's evaluation, as well as next week's evaluation, all the evaluations throughout the strand. We are raffling off a special book, Academic Vocabulary in Middle and High School. I'm very pleased to see our winner of the first book, Kathy, on, and our winner from last week, I'm pleased to announce today, is Sandy Thorpe from Bay Trail Middle School in Penfield, New York. And Sandy, your book was sent last week, so hopefully it has made its way to you. If not, give it a day or two and reach out to me. We'll figure that out, but I hope you have it and we're excited for you. The New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center is pleased to have Dr. Catherine Stahl back with us to present the third webinar in a four-session webinar strand, Teaching Academic Vocabulary Across All Content Areas in Grades 3 through 8. Today's topic is Teaching Academic Vocabulary Part 1. Dr. Stahl is a clinical professor of literacy at New York University. She is committed to improving student achievement and school effectiveness, especially in urban settings. She is currently the director of the NYU Literacy Clinic, and for over 25 years, she has taught in high-poverty public elementary and middle school classrooms. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Stahl.
Thank you very much, Molly, and welcome back to all of you. I'm glad to see some familiar names. And it was such a delight yesterday at the Doug Fisher workshop in New Rochelle. I was actually able to meet in person Kathy Rogers Gaines. So hopefully some of you will be there tomorrow. I will also, or not tomorrow, I will be at the Doug Fisher workshop also next Tuesday that is being held here in New York City, actually on the NYU campus. So hopefully some of you will be attending that, and I hope you'll come up and introduce yourselves to me so I can put a face with your name. Let's continue. I've also been very happy to see that several of you have submitted some word selection documents where you went through the exercise of creating a word list of target vocabulary for a unit, an upcoming content unit that you'll be working on. And Molly, some of you were able to just submit those into the Google folder yourselves, or those other people who created those shared them with Molly, and she in turn actually put them into the Google document. They are currently visible to everyone. If you just simply click the link that you were sent related to that Google folder. Looking here and seeing that again, we have a good number of elementary teachers and lots of administrators. Still hoping, oh good, we've got an ELA teacher, certainly hoping that we would have some middle school content area teachers, but I suspect that some of our special ed populations, our special ed teachers are working, are working in content area classes. Renee, I wish you had come up and introduced yourself to me. I'm seeing here in the comments that Renee was also at the conference yesterday. So please, for anyone who is attending the workshop next Tuesday in New York City, please come up to me and say hello. I would love to meet you. We have another poll so that I can get a sense of, who are the people, to see if we have any new people. Please submit that you have already viewed vocabulary 1 and 2, even if you did not necessarily participate live, but if you just even viewed it on the archive, please be sure to, give yourself credit for having viewed the vocabulary, that webinar. So it looks like we have, the majority of people have attended both webinars. And then we have a couple people who have, and we don't have anybody here that has not seen any of the webinars. So this will be fine. I am going to do a very brief review simply because, so Molly, we can go on. So I am going to do a very brief review of some of the content simply to get us warmed up. And so that when the terms that I'm using in speaking about the activities, some of that terminology will be fresh for you. And I don't ever think that it hurts to have some distributed practice and reminders either, even for things that we know. Once again, my resources that I'm using will be this wonderful book, Academic Vocabulary in Middle and High School by Donna Ogle, Camille Blackowitz, Peter Fisher, and Laura, Lamb, I believe it is. And some of the other ideas that I will be using today, I believe, and then also I'll be using the book Vocabulary Their Way. Most of my ideas are coming from these two sources. And I heartily recommend that when the webinars are over, that particularly for those of you who are doing professional development with your schools and doing turnkey activities, and using these same materials to turnkey to your school, I really recommend that Donna Ogle et al. Book, because it really has, not only does it have the kind of holistic activities that I am sharing with you and will be sharing with you today that are applicable regardless of whether you're teaching ELA, social studies, science, or math, but they actually do have a chapter for each content area that I find it very, very useful for disciplinary teams to revisit that chapter and to... because there are some unique ways within each discipline to introduce and to talk about and to practice some of the vocabulary in that discipline. So I'm just going to go over, as I said, I'm just going to give a brief review, even though most of you have been here for both of these, because today we're really going to be talking about the instruction. And I know a couple people mentioned, I really wish we had been able to start out with the instruction. But we can't really start out with instruction without knowing what our target vocabulary are and really going through that selection process so that we can categorize, because not all words are to be instructed in the same way. We need to instruct the words differently. We also don't really know which words we need to provide heavier instruction on and which words may not need to be, we don't need to devote any time to them at all if students already have mastery of particular words. So that's why it's very important for us to be doing the kinds of pre-assessments that we talked about last week or 2 weeks ago when the last time we met, that we need to be doing those pre-assessments. So that kind of information is essential and prerequisite to beginning instruction. And so, let me remind you that the techniques that we're talking about today are specific to academic vocabulary, that these techniques are specific to academic vocabulary, they're either general academic vocabulary, which are simply words that tend to appear in most content area instruction. However, they are not necessarily used in everyday conversation. We are going to be talking about domain-specific vocabulary, which are isolated and used typically in just a particular single content. Most of these are going to be tier 3 words. The nice thing about academic vocabulary, and particularly this domain-specific vocabulary. And I say this not only for the middle schools, but particularly for those people, anyone here who's involved in elementary school, is we really want to emphasize in our literacy program, you know, if you have a literacy block, really consider doing your disciplinary instruction during that time block. Because this domain-specific vocabulary, particularly if you are in a school that has many English language learners, when we are teaching content area instruction, what ends up happening is in content area instruction, we have a fairly organic repetition and multiple exposures of those words as we go through the content, as we go through the unit. And that kind of organic, repeated exposure in hands-on experiences, in talking about what we're doing, perhaps if it's a science class, in hearing or in reading ourselves information about the topic, those same words tend to recur over and over. And finally, in students writing, they're going to be actually writing words that we hope are on a word wall and that are our target vocabulary that they have already had multiple experiences with. So for this reason, you know, domain-specific vocabulary, although in some ways it's more complex, if we are teaching in settings in which we have many English language learners, this is a very nice place for them to develop their vocabulary because of the organic, repeated exposures in all of those different ways, in all of those different ways. And typically that kind of domain-specific vocabulary is what we call Tier 3 vocabulary. It's the tier, what we see here in Beck and McCown's categorization of vocabulary, it's Tier 3. So these are the terms that are specific to a disciplinary content area, and the children or the students do not have the conceptual knowledge necessary to understand it. So unlike a Tier 2 word, which we often can teach using a synonym, even though we do want to have multiple exposures so that they become more adept at using those words, saying those words, retrieving those words, even Tier 2 words, we want multiple exposures. But the Tier 3 words, but for Tier 2 words, the kids already know the content. So we really may do a faster kind of instruction with Tier 2 words. Now, sometimes in academic vocabulary, the words that are Tier 2 words are those more general academic vocabulary words that appear across disciplines. Things like observe, words like evaluate. Those are words that are in the Tier 2 category. So students might use a less sophisticated word for them in their vocabulary, or they may know a nuance of the meaning, whereas in the discipline it's being used in a very specific way. Tier 3 words, however, are going to require a much more detailed kind of instruction. And they are going to have to require what we call crisscrossing the landscape, because these are words like democracy, photosynthesis, that what you're doing is you're actually building the knowledge of these words. So you can't just give them a synonym for these words. And we certainly, and of course, I know that the folks that are attending, oh, good, I'm seeing down here some people confirming that they are in middle school. And so, for example, Jessica, who's a math teacher in grade 7 to 9, you know, I'm sure you're coming across several disciplinary words that you could have your kids look them up in the glossary or give them the definition for the math term, but they're not really going to understand that math vocabulary word unless they are actually doing something related to that terminology or doing some hands-on activities with that terminology and having experiences with the concept. And so that's what's unique about Tier 3. And that has a very strong influence on the kind of instruction we are providing. And again, we said that, we want to make sure that in our instruction, we are addressing all of these components that we're having kids, providing opportunity for kids to hear and discuss the words in group discussion settings. We're having kids write the words or see the words written in what they're reading, and also opportunities for them to write. People really enjoyed and I think took away a lot from this graphic that we had in our first webinar, which was all the different kinds of components, the actual components of vocabulary instruction. Today, we're going to be focusing on the best ways to teach individual words. That is going to be the focus for today. And then we are going to have another focus today of teaching word learning strategies. Now, next week, we will have more opportunities and talk a little bit more about fostering word consciousness and providing rich and varied language experiences. But these are not finite. I mean, you will see today when we go through the different instructional activities, you'll see how some of these do have overlap. They do overlap, but the two focus ones that I'm really going to try to hit hard for you today are what are the best ways to teach individual words, and what about those kinds of self-learning strategies? What are some of those, and how should we approach them? So many of you have already gone through this process, so you're ready now to begin in your unit plan that you're creating. You already have in your unit plan folder, you have your words that you've selected. You have your assessments that you're going to be using. You have on that chart, you also categorized the words according to that chart that we had. Within our instruction, we want to make sure, and today we're going to talk about how do we provide the introductory explicit instruction that is needed with a definition, and then provide ongoing opportunities, and that will include what we do next week to build incremental knowledge throughout the unit so that they are interacting with these words in multidimensional ways through different approaches, so that they're getting opportunities to experience listening, speaking, reading, and writing with the words. You can't do that by just giving kids a list of words on day one or day two of the unit and say, look these words up in your glossary. That doesn't cut it. And they really need to have the multidimensional and multimodal experiences. We also are going to talk a little bit about having these words posted and some ways that needs to be done and the importance of it. And then we're going to finish out our session today talking about morphology. Now, we do know that vocabulary learning is both incidental and intentional. And so the intentional learning, we're going to talk about that today with our first half of our activities will be the intentional learning, where we as teachers are teaching these things explicitly. We're teaching definitions. We're teaching individual words, and we're providing the kids with their definitions. We're not having the kids write the definitions themselves and then maybe write a sentence with it. We're providing multiple contexts across our unit, and we'll expand that next week, and word relationships. This is the thing that when I asked Beck and McCowan about the current status of vocabulary instruction, they said vocabulary instruction has certainly come to the forefront a bit more, and teachers are doing more deliberate work. But they said that the one area that seems to still be suffering is building relationships, getting kids to see the relationships between words within the unit. We're doing a better job with multiple exposures, and, you know, we're fostering word consciousness. And again, we're going to talk today about word learning strategies so that then children can have that incidental learning. That incidental learning doesn't just happen by magic. It's because we have actually taught these word learning strategies deliberately in school. Okay, so you're starting with when you're thinking about which of these techniques, you're not going to just pluck these techniques that I'm sharing with you today and next week. You're not just going to pluck them and use them for your units of instruction. You have created, if you're going to be using any of the activities, and I hope you're not getting impatient with such a big introduction to the instruction of these words, but it's really important for you to be very deliberate in how you're going to teach the words, because your time is valuable. And I mean, and the whole goal is that you're teaching content. And so you want to make sure that the way in which you're choosing to introduce and teach vocabulary is a way that is matched with what the word is. You know, why teach a word, you know, over 6 lessons if it's one of those words like provinces that can be taught relatively quickly, you know, in a tier 2 fashion? Why spend time getting kids to, you know, find definitions and going crazy and devoting class time to the word bastion if you're wanting them to infer that word and use their context clues? So, you know, you really want to, that chart that you made and that several of you have put in those Google folders, that is a crucial stage of your vocabulary instruction. So we're going to be talking about, you know, because there are 3 ways to teach words: flooding them with words, the fast way that we're going to do with tier 2, and then the focus elaborated instruction for tier 3. So now we're ready to talk about how do we actually do it? How is it that we actually teach the individual words? Okay. Explicitly teaching definitions is indeed required. Okay, we do, for if you have selected those words on your chart, then we want to be the ones that are assuming responsibility for teaching the definitions for each target word that is not categorized as infer. So if you have words on your list that are categorized as either fast or, what was the other one? Fast or focused teaching? Then you're going to be the person, you are the one responsible for teaching the word. So for how to teach the tier 2 words, those words that you have categorized as fast, these are words, remember, these are words for which children already have the concept. They just are not able to use the word, the sophisticated word. And they may not be aware of the nuances of the sophisticated word. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to have the word on a word card. You're going to show the word to the students, and you're going to teach them how to pronounce it. And you're going to have them read the word from the card. We want them, you know, there are lots of words that I know in reading and that when I read them in a book, but I can promise you, if I was sitting among a group of teachers, I might be hesitant to say the word because I'm not really sure of the correct pronunciation, or maybe I can't retrieve it that quickly to use it properly and to say the word correctly because I've only seen the word in reading. So we want to make sure when we're teaching our words, even these older students, that we give them an opportunity to say the words. Then we want to provide a student-friendly definition. That means you yourself can't just look up the word in the glossary. You're going to have to prep for this. You're going to have to look the word up in the glossary to make sure you are giving a precise meaning and that your meaning is on target. And then you're going to have to translate that into a student-friendly definition. And then number 4 is huge. Sometimes my student teachers like to argue with me about this number 4. They provide 3 additional verbal examples of the words in sentences and prepare this in advance. So you should have, you know, a little post-it, or I like to prepare this. I like to make on the word cards. I like to put all this information on the back of the word card. I have the word on the front of the word card, and then on the back of the word card, I put my definition for it, my student-friendly definition, and I think ahead on Friday afternoon when I'm having my cup of tea, my Moroccan mint tea, then that's when I'm sitting there and I'm writing my example sentences, because I'm not good on my feet, and I cannot come up with a great precise sentence or a good prompt for my students to generate sentences on the fly. And time is valuable. Every second that you're hemming and hawing to try to come up with a sentence, or not giving a precise prompt that's going to generate a good, that's going to help them generate a good sentence, is wasted time in our classroom. So you want to have your three verbal sentences. Now I have, and then the next thing you're going to do in step five is you are going to, using your pre-planned prompt, you are going to ask about three students to generate a sentence for the entire class to hear. So you'll say to the kids, so let's say the word, this is my go-to example, fragile. You might say, describe something that you know that is fragile, or describe why something is fragile. A Christmas ornament is fragile because it is made of very thin glass, would be the example. So you're not going to just say use fragile in a sentence. You are going to generate a prompt for it. And the students, then you'll get a couple students to generate a good sentence. Now, here is what my students all like to argue with me about. But it's more student involvement if we get everybody to write a sentence and then turn and talk and share it. But if they do that, they're not hearing three contexts. The other thing is, if they do it that way, you're not able to provide feedback to know that they're actually using the word correctly. So the way Beck and McCown researched this model of how to teach two words was using this set of six steps. Now, certainly, as a follow-up, there's nothing to prohibit you from, as a follow-up, to get the kids as an independent activity or as a small group activity to get them to share words, that the sentences that they've written, maybe give them 5 minutes to write something. You know, you can certainly do that as a follow-up activity. You know, that's part of your, you know, multiple exposures. But the first five steps, before you get to step six and have them writing sentences or doing any kind of relationship activities, steps one through five are the steps that you want to follow. Next, Marzano's six-step process. Now, this is his process for Tier 3 academic vocabulary. Once again, please do not skip any steps, all right? So it's similar to the Tier 2 in some ways, but remember, these are words that the kids don't have the concept. The Tier 2 words, the kids have the concept, you know, they just didn't know that particular word for it. Now, these are words, however, that the kids, and these are your words like democracy or immigration, for which the kids may not have a clear idea of the definition. So in this, you're going to, again, provide a description, explanation, or example for the term. So particularly in math and science, you may need to be giving, or even in social studies, you may need to be giving as part of the definition some examples right away. So then step two is have the students restate the description, may an explanation or example in their own words. So now they're going to paraphrase. They might be generating some of their own examples. This is all happening verbally. There's not any writing going on yet. Next, there would be a non-linguistic definition if possible. Maybe if there is some way, you know, to have an illustration or some other, particularly in math, some of the symbolic representations for that. Jessica, you know, I'm sure that these are things that you're immediately bringing to mind where you would go in step three for some kind of model, or in science, model. In ELA, maybe acting out some of the descriptive language or the kind of craftsmanship that's happening in something you're reading. Then step four is the teacher extends and refines understanding of the word by engaging students in activities that help them add to their knowledge of the terms in vocabulary notebooks. So most of you in content areas are going to want to have your students documenting what they're learning about these words in vocabulary notebooks. And so that way they can be adding to it throughout the unit, because these are words that are not going to be, they're going to be introduced in one lesson, but across the lessons they're going to be exposed to these words over and over, and you may be having them doing two or three other activities that will consolidate and expand their knowledge of this vocabulary. Step five, periodically ask the students to discuss the terms with one another. For example, in speed dating, which we're going to talk about today. But you want to make sure that you're having the kids, when you're thinking of how am I teaching these most complex words, am I giving opportunities for kids to hear them, say them, discuss them, all right, read them, and write them? And so that can be a check that you as teacher make for each of your vocabulary words that you've selected. Have I provided opportunities for my students to engage in those four ways with each word that I want them to come away with knowing? And then certainly involve students in games that enable them to play with the terms and reinforce word knowledge as well. Another thing that is totally essential and non-negotiable that's at this introductory part of the word work is interactive word walls. And so every unit that you're doing, and I know, and so, you know, let's say you're teaching social studies in a middle school. In elementary classrooms, this is easy because everybody is doing, you know, you have your classroom and you're doing, all of the kids in the class, we're all doing the same science unit or we're all doing the same social studies unit. As a middle school teacher, it might get a little trickier. It might get a little trickier because you might have one grade level class doing one unit, and then you have another grade level class doing an entirely different unit. But you really need to think about how to use your space in your room so that you can have some kind of interactive word wall that addresses each unit that you are teaching during a particular time frame. The words certainly are aligned with current instruction. They have to be visible from a distance because we want the kids to be able to be using these words when they're doing their writing that you're having them do related to your unit. And you might have them in a range. You're not going to have them in a traditional word wall like alphabetically. You're going to have them more like a concept map so that they're arranged, or a flow chart so that the words are actually arranged to illustrate the relationships and organize learning. And then over time, students may be adding things to this word wall. You know, they might be adding illustrations as you as time proceeds. Things like photographs, pictures, or actual items and realia. And the wall would be actively used during most lessons to review concepts. I mean, you're going to be actually often bringing attention to that wall and where things, maybe where my ideas are organized on that concept web. So it's really more of a web or a flow chart. It's the word wall itself in content areas actually reflects the relationships between the words, which is different than a regular little primary grade or elementary, a lower elementary kind of word wall. These are also the words that are no excuses words when your students are writing. They are supposed to be using this word wall to spell the words correctly. Do you consistently use an interactive word wall for academic vocabulary in each unit? Thank you for your honesty. I am so appreciative of people saying that they typically have not done this in the past. And I certainly hope that this is something, this is an easy takeaway. This is something that you can easily integrate without much trouble, easily integrate into your routines. And it makes a big difference. Thank you very much, and I'm so grateful for your honesty. Now, here is one of my favorites, and last year when I was doing this activity with MS-447, this was a fabulous activity that the teachers at MS-447 really were excited about, and several of those teachers had already done something like this, and so they were very excited to share it with others that in this activity, the class, the students themselves make a hypermedia dictionary. So the unit focus words are distributed to students, and the responsibility for dictionary entries is divided among them early in the unit. So the kids are each given one or two words, probably one, you know, because you only have about 25 words. So each kid is given one of the words that you're studying in the unit. And you decide what platform you're going to use, and it's an electronic platform that you're going to use. I actually experimented with Quizlet, and it was very easy to use, and I used the free version, and it also had other resources. So perhaps some of you who have done hypermedia dictionaries, if any of you have done hypermedia dictionaries, if you could type in the chat box what program or what platform you use, that might be helpful to the rest of us that are looking at it. I see Helen here said she's used Quizlet and it was easy and fun for the kids to use. And Renee, you've used it, but you know, the kids can actually do it. I noticed that there's a way for you to, on the platform, there's a way for you to give students the access to it. Throughout the unit, students are adding additional information to the class dictionary. Now, certainly you want to create a template with entry components that you require. So, for example, the definitions in the student's own words, in addition to a formal definition, what part of speech it is, maybe some kind of visual. So you would create the template and then they would have to include all of those parts to this. And I would start out simply. You know, start out with a simple format, and then as you do this over the months, you know, you can make it a little more complex. And so here, this is an example of what I did using Quizlet for COSBA. You see here it has the speaker where it's actually the pronunciation. That was easy. I mean, I'm not super technologically savvy, and even I could make the definition show up on the Quizlet form, on the Quizlet card. Here we have a definition and a visual to go along with it. So it's very easy, very fun, and it's a wonderful class resource. Have you ever had your students make collaborative hypermedia dictionaries for your disciplinary content unit? Great. This is another one, folks, that I think is going to be pretty easy for you to insert into your units. I think it's easy, and I think the kids would have fun doing it, and it's not too time intensive either. It's, you know, I think this would be something that's a real easy do. Great. And here is my favorite technique of the day. Speed dating. Vocabulary speed dating. So this, as you see this routine, I used to do this. I never did it with vocabulary. I've done it with other activities. I didn't know it was called speed dating. I called it the train, because what I would do is I would have my students, I would have a group of, say, half of my students just line up in a row, and then the other half of the students lined up in another row face to face. They were facing each other. And so they would be sharing either a project or sharing an opinion or sharing some kind of verbal exchange. And then I would time the timer for like 2 minutes. And then one group stayed where they were and the other group moved down one person. And so it's, and so then when I saw this, I went, oh, yeah, that's exactly what it should be called. I always called it the train, but it makes sense to call it speed dating. So you have the person in orange is, the person in blue is staying in place, and the person in orange is moving, all right? So the people in blue stay where they are, the people in orange move. So you can use this with any number. Here are some different kind of vocabulary speed dating prompts you could use. So you could actually have the kids exchanging their dictionary entry, exchanging it, sharing it with a friend, then moving to the next one. You could have them have their vocabulary notebook, maybe something that's in their vocabulary notebook or their word journal, have some kind of exchange there with words that they actually saw in a book that they were reading. Which words did they pick out that were interesting? Share that with someone. A vocabulary word hunt. I saw some YouTube videos on that. And then also, when we get to talking about morphemes, having that morpheme word generation exchange. So, for example, if in my vocabulary notebook, we're all generating words that have the root S-P-I-R. So I've made a list in my vocabulary notebook. Everybody else has made a list in their vocabulary notebook. And so now we can actually do it speed dating and possibly add some more words to ours based on our speed dating experience. Now, I know you all know this one. Every single classroom that I visit has this, the Frayer model. Do you currently use the Foursquare graphic organizer as an academic vocabulary activity? Yeah, most people, a lot of people use this. This is very popular. Engage New York used a lot of these models, because every school I go into, the people, this is one of the only ways they are using, that they're doing to teach vocabulary. So you can certainly continue using this, but maybe not use it excessively. You know, hopefully you'll have some new tools. Okay, Molly, we can go to the next thing. So the original Foursquare model was that students would put the definition, and the graphic should look like this. The word in the middle, and then four opportunities to tell something about the word. So the original was the definition went in one box, characteristics of the word in another box, examples in another box, and non-examples. So that's the original. So what you can do, though, is you can do alternatives to those four, or you can do additional squares. So, for example, you could actually do synonym, you know, so each of these headings would be a different box. You could have a synonym box. You could have an antonym box. You could have morphemes. Are there related morphemes? Are there other related words, either morphologically related to this word or semantically related? What other words, when we think of this word, what else is related to it? They could have to write a sentence. If you're in a group that has lots of English learners, what are some cognates? You know, what are the cognates of this particular word? Non-examples. I just want to make sure that everybody knows what a non-example is. That term gets thrown around a lot, but you rarely see it defined. And I think also that this is a very powerful tool. And so we really want to have a clear understanding of it. So a non-example is a word that does not meet the definition, all right, that we're looking for. Often, the things that fit into the non-example box are a member of the superordinate group. So, for example, I usually do a concept map for computer, the word computer, all right? And so a member, so for example, something like a cash register. Yes, it's a cash register is in the same category, it's in the same superordinate group, but it's missing particular features required to fit within a specific subcategory of that superordinate group. So that's what makes it a non-example, that it could be mistaken for. It shares some features, but it's not the same. Another thing you could have the kids do is put a definition in my words. You could have them do a textbook or a dictionary definition and an illustration, all things that could be occurring. Now our word learning strategies. So the two word learning strategies that we want to focus on are morphology. And again, morphemes are the smallest units of meaning. Free morphemes form words independently, but often have other morphemes attached to refine their meaning or change their tense. For example, let's say the word change, all right? Change, or let's use care. Care is a free morpheme. We can certainly add other morphemes to it, like careful. We could add full. We could add an ending to change the tense, caring. Care still stands alone, all right? Peace. Peace is a free morpheme. So we certainly can add other things to it, like able, to make it peaceable, all right? But it still is a free morpheme. On the other hand, we have bound morphemes. These have meaning, but they do not form a word, all right? So, for example, VIS, SPIR, ABLE, those are all bound morphemes that maybe ABLE probably should not be in there. Sorry about that. I was thinking of it in terms of a suffix when I generated that list, but that would be considered a free morpheme. The other topic that we're going to be talking about is utilization of context clues. Does your school or school district currently have a prescribed explicit scope and sequence for teaching morphology? No. Okay. Yeah, I sort of did expect it. I'm good. I'm glad I'm seeing that a couple people, have one, which is interesting. But I'm not sure. I think one of those people, let me know in your comments if this is right. Somebody asked me either last week or the week before that we met, either in session one or session two, about the routine of the Cunningham routine for the Nifty 50 Thrifty. So is that one of the people saying yes? So let me know. Okay, Molly, we can go to the next one. Okay, Shava, that was you. So did you also include yourself as a yes that we have one? Okay. Okay. So guidelines for teaching morphology. Guidelines. Everyone benefits from learning how to apply morphological units. So you should develop a school-wide plan that is developmentally driven and transparent to everybody, not haphazard and not left to individuals. So you want to get a list and make a scope and sequence. or use the scope and sequence that's in Vocabulary Their Way or the Words Their Way program, they have a very logical, research-validated scope and sequence for this. Even if you don't necessarily want to use the Words Their Way program or the Vocabulary Their Way program, at least use that scope and sequence because it's very, it's done by science, it's done by research, and it's very developmentally driven. I do recommend that the ELA teams drive the instruction with explicit follow-up provided in the content areas as specific morphemes are encountered. Because those of you who are science and social studies teachers, you're going to encounter lots of these prefixes and suffixes in your actual teaching. So when those opportunities arise, take advantage of them and reteach those morphemes and talk about in a very deep way the meaning of it because you're in an content area teachers are in an ideal situation to really put those words into action and into contextual situations, into context. Instruction should also be active. I know a lot of people as a quick fix for this, and it certainly is well-intentioned. It certainly is well-intentioned, is that they buy a program that does this for them. And so this way, one can relieve guilt and say, well, we're doing it because our kids have the such-and-such book. And so in the such-and-such book, they do all the prefixes and suffixes are covered, and that's where they do it. But the problem with that is it's passive. And we know that in order for vocabulary to be learned, instruction has to be active. And also, students need vocabulary notebooks for this process, because a good deal of the work should require the students, once they know what the meaning of that morpheme is, getting them to generate more words and define clusters of words that are semantically and morphologically related. And so in order for them to be able to do that, this is where you want the dictionaries. This is where you want kids digging into etymological dictionaries so that they can find related words. I think by actually having activities and having games, and again, Renee, I think that the Words Their Way model and that Words Their Way, it's the chapter that talks derivatives, all of those are active activities where the kids are actually generating activities or they're playing Jeopardy with different morphemes. And so it's all very, very active and it's very generative. It's not them sitting there filling which word goes in the blank or just dividing, making sentences from the words, or saying yes or no, this is a real word. So it's really being them actually doing the generating of the words. I hope that helps. Now, and again, for a thorough discussion, Words Their Way, 6th edition, Barrett Al. Or Vocabulary Their Way, Word Study for Middle and Secondary Students. Both of those can show you how to do that in more active ways. And Words Their Way actually has a very good, and I imagine Vocabulary Their Way does too. I don't have it right in front of me. Have that scope and sequence. Now also, the last time we were together, I mentioned that blog by Tim Shanahan in which he recently spoke about morphemes and how to teach morphology to older students. And so he was referencing two researchers, and so I followed up with that so that I could share that information with you today. And folks, it's called Structured Word Inquiry. And I'm sorry, I should have put the author's names on this page. I don't think I did that. No, I didn't. There are about three authors, and they have the same name. I imagine two are brothers, and one might be the spouse of one of them. But they have structured word, it's called Structured Word Inquiry. That's the formal name for it. And there are tons of resources on this website here. If you go to this website, you will find many, many, many resources. Now, this is a this is actually Orton Gillingham related. These folks are somehow related to the Orton Gillingham line of thinking. And so I think they have relationships with Orton Gillingham. So this may be in the Orton Gillingham, and I could be wrong about this, but in the developmental trajectory and scope and sequence that Orton Gillingham follows, this may be their way of approaching and teaching and dealing with that derivative stage of development. And so it is certain these resources, though, are certainly worth a look. And you know, using some of them. And I think they actually go all over and conduct workshops as well that you might want to investigate. Yeah, so it does. Right, it makes sense. So, but there, you know, this was a resource that, you know, it's always wonderful to do these webinars because I always learn a lot as well, both from you and in my preparation. And so this was new to me, and it is certainly something I will be continuing to investigate. Have you ever asked students to use the context to determine the meaning of an unknown word? Have you ever done that? I suspect that we all have. I suspect that we all have. And in fact, I hope that we all have, because that is a very powerful, we want children to be self-sufficient, and we know that the majority of the vocabulary words that kids learn are learned incidentally. And so the utilization of context is a very important skill. So we want kids to be able to do that. So Molly, that's great. So I'm on the next slide now. Now, Blackowitz and Fisher, this was some earlier work. You know, this was not the work that was in the book that that we're using, that's Donna Ogle is the first author. This is in an earlier book by Blackowitz and Fisher that was vocabulary development, or vocabulary for elementary. And so they teach context clues just about better than anybody I have ever known. And so, because they really put it in a clear step-by-step way, is that we can't just say to kids, well, infer this word, or I think you can, let's use our context to figure this out. For one thing, context doesn't always provide the information that we need. For another reason, sometimes the context can be misleading. In another context, you know, the clues may not be there. And so, you know, we want to be very careful when we say to kids, use the context. We had better, in our head, know precisely which context we wanted them to use to make that inference about the meaning. The next thing we have to do, so we have to teach kids why to use context and when to use context. We also have to teach them the different kinds of context clues, all right, and how to find those clues. You know, they don't always come right next to the word. They don't always, you know, they sometimes are circumstantial. Sometimes it's circumstantial evidence. It's not just a phrase. It's not just a synonym. And so this was very powerful to me. Blackowitz and Fisher recommend that the best way to teach kids how to use context clues is by having the students collect throughout their reading over a period of a month or so, have them collect, explain, and display examples of context clues in what you all have read over a period of time. And so some of the kinds of context clues that you would have, let's say you have a big bulletin board. And so in this bulletin board, you have it divided like a chart or a table. So one box would be synonyms. And so the students, as they are reading, if there is a synonym that is providing a clue to a troublesome word's meaning, then they would copy out that phrase and put it in that box on your bulletin board. Or another kind of context clue is what a word is or is not like. You know, if it's something is different than this or not like this or it's like such and such, that would be another category. Something about the setting. If a word is describing a setting or it is related to the time and place, that would be a category. Something about what a word is used for. You know, sometimes you see something, well, oh, this word must be used for such and such. I don't know exactly what it looks like, but I know it's a tool to be used in this particular way. Often, this would probably be a fairly common one, a word, an unknown word being some kind of action or some kind of thing. This would be another very common one, how something is done. Or sometimes we just have to make inferences based on the general ideas in, a paragraph. And so I heard Doug Fisher say something yesterday, and I hope I can recall it at this time. He said, and maybe you can remember it too, Kathy, you were there, and the other person who said that they were there yesterday. Doug Fisher said, in terms of using context clues, he tells the kids to look on the inside of the word to find morphological clues, and then look on the outside to find context clues. I thought that was a very powerful comment. And maybe Kathy and Renee, tell me if I'm remembering what he said correctly. He said, so he tells his kids when they come to an unknown word, look on the inside of the word and on the outside. You're looking on the inside for known parts, morphological units that may be familiar that you can chunk it, and look on the outside for clues, these kinds of context clues that you see on this slide to give you support in terms of determining the meaning. Okay. Here's another process for doing that. So the metacognitive process for using context. So that was a very simple phrase to remember. Here are the steps that Blackowitz and Fisher recommend using. So they say that this is a metacognitive process if you're going to use the context. But first, you have to have taught the kids what those different kinds of context clues are. But now here are the steps that kids can use. And you want to provide explicit instruction in these steps. You want to model these steps for kids many times and then provide guided practice to teach these steps so that over time, through explicitly learning these steps, through teacher modeling of the steps, and through practice together, then using and referencing some of those samples that they collected, hopefully then students will have a protocol to use. They will have the procedure. They will have the process for doing it. It's not just use context and you're on your own. This, you know, we have to help kids have a process for using context. We can't just say use the context, and let's hope that the context is there to provide this. So the four steps are look. Similar to inside, outside, look before the word, at the word, and after the target word. So that's the same as our inside, outside. Then we take it a step further. Think about it. Connect your knowledge with the clues in the text, the comprehension of that passage, of that paragraph, what you've been reading. Connect it to the word. Predict a possible meaning, and then resolve redo or consult another source if it doesn't seem to be working as you proceed. So you can either, you know, if that doesn't all work, you either resolve, redo it, or consult another source. And there may be sometimes, I know Doug Fisher said yesterday he doesn't like the idea of skip being a step, but I think we do have to, in terms of when we're thinking about comprehension, I do believe that when I am reading, there are many words that are not crucial to the understanding of the text, that if I don't understand them, I am not going to disrupt my comprehension process to try to figure it out, use a dictionary, or ask somebody, because it's not that relevant, you know, it's not hindering my meaning that much. So I think that is another thing, that how much energy do we need? We need to balance and teach our kids to balance the amount of energy and disruption invested in finding a meaning of a word, because we want to know that it's in service to comprehension. So if comprehension is not hindered, then doing too much to disrupt the process is not the best strategy. But I think this is a very nice procedure, and I think that we have to be a little more mindful in actually teaching kids and not assuming that the third grade teacher taught them or that the elementary school taught them how to use context. So our last poll is, was the technique that you personally use to teach your students how and when to use context as explicit as the Blackwoods and Fisher technique? Because we really want to be thorough in teaching this. And I think often as teachers of middle school or fifth grade, our kids know so much that we often assume that they learned this as well before they got to us. So hopefully this will be something that you can interject in your teaching as well. Okay, thanks, Molly. Okay, so next week, we'll be together next week, and we'll be learning some more techniques, and these tend to be techniques that provide rich and varied language experiences, and a few of the techniques I'm going to share are vocabograms, story impressions, possible sentences, and a few more tools in my toolkit. Do we have any questions today? We still have about 10 minutes left, and I know this was the topic that many people were most interested in. So are there any questions that you have? Yes, I think that was, that sounds terrific. Ideas. So that's a nice acronym. Inference, using what you already know, again. Definition, examples. Is there an explicit definition? Are there examples? And antonym and synonym. Oh, that's terrific. Yeah. I hadn't heard that before, Renee. That's a good one. It's a little abbreviated. Yeah, sometimes the definition is part of the passage. I don't think we can always count on that, though. I don't think we can count on that. Oh, Nancy, you know what I was going to mention at the end? I agree. That is a lot to do for one teacher. I'll be honest with you, and I think the ELA teachers might not like to hear me say this, but I do think, I think that is one area that the ELA teachers might take on. And again, I think that this is the kind of thing that needs to be a school decision. You know, where kids do need to know, and they need to learn how to use context clues, and they need to learn how to use the context you know, whenever possible to determine a meaning. But I think that maybe the ELA teachers, you know, would be able to do this more organically than asking a math teacher to do it, or than asking a science teacher to do it. And again, we would want the science teachers to know this so that they, when they're teaching, that they can possibly cue their kids. You know, let's say they're reading a history, let's say they're reading some kind of historical document. They could provide, they should know this process so that they know what are the context clues that their students have been taught so that they can be using the same language. But perhaps the preliminary instruction could come in the ELA teacher.
Looks like there's a few more people typing, but I'm going to post the evaluation while everybody's while we're wrapping up here.
Oh, with the reading interventionist, yes, yes. But the thing, the reading teachers, right, the ELA teacher is concerned with the methods by which vocabulary is taught in the content areas, right? And so that's why I think that I think that this is more, you know, ELA teachers have been taught about how to use context clues. So whereas many disciplinary teachers did not have that kind of training. So, you know, it would be, you know, probably in the ELA classroom. And I think it could happen fairly organically in there. But to make sure that everybody knows that that's what's being taught is the thing, you know, and so that we're all on the same page. So.
I think we have one more typing.
Yes.
While she's typing, I do hope everybody will do the survey. And again, we are going to raffle off a copy of the book if you put your contact information at the bottom, the last question on the evaluation. So I'm excited. I'll announce the winner next week, and it's been great to have those winners on the call.
Yes, and I look forward to it. I see Renee is still typing, but I do look forward. So we will be together this time next Thursday. So next Thursday will be our last session on vocabulary. Oh, well, absolutely, yes. Yes, we are, the vocabulary. Well, see, and that's what this academic vocabulary we are assuming. I am assuming this was really designed for content area teachers. This presentation was designed with the social studies teacher, the math teacher, the science teacher, the ELA teacher in mind. That's who this was designed for. Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, and I look forward. Hopefully, I'll see a few of you on Tuesday. Please come say hello to me if you're in New York City at the Doug Fisher presentation. And otherwise, I will see you virtually on Thursday at 4:15.
That's great. Thank you so much, Dr. Stahl, and I look forward to seeing everybody back next week. Take care, everyone.
Thank you, Molly.
You're welcome.